I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie spent a busy day in New Hampshire yesterday. Although he's not a declared presidential candidate and trails in the polls, he did sound like one, proposing changes to entitlement programs, criticizing President Obama on foreign policy, and claiming he could beat Hillary Clinton if he ran. Matt Katz has been covering Chris Christie for New Jersey Public Radio for WNYC and joins us on Radio Times. Matt, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Marty. Good to be here.
Let me play a clip, and this is Chris Christie speaking yesterday. He is announcing his plans for Social Security and Medicare reform, and this is at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. I have to say we edited this clip for brevity. Let's give it a listen.
Today, we know this. Our entitlement system is out of control. Its growth is not sustainable, and inaction threatens the economic health of every generation that will follow us. And let me ask you this. Why would I say it if it wasn't true? I mean, there's no political upside to this, right? Okay? So why would I come here and say all these things if they weren't true? I'd love to come here and just give you a happy time. Make you feel good. Say I'm going to give you a whole lot more money from someplace. The only reason I'm here to say this is because it is an unavoidable truth. And that's why I'm so pleased that you let me join you here today in New Hampshire, coincidentally, to talk about the future of our country. Thank you for giving me the time today. God bless you all. God bless America.
So, Matt Katz, what was Chris Christie doing in New Hampshire yesterday?
Well, you know, re-listening to that clip, he certainly sounds like a presidential candidate.
Sure does.
I mean, and that's pretty much what he was doing. I mean, he is ramping up to make an announcement for president. So the first thing he did was come out with a relatively specific plan about reforming entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, disability insurance, and the big one, Social Security. It's the most specific plan about entitlements that any of the confirmed candidates and potential candidates have so far released. And he wanted to show that he's, you know, a bold truth teller, and he was going to say some uncomfortable realities about our entitlement system, and he's using that as the rationale about why he should be president, both specifically on this plan, but the larger shtick of being the guy who tells it like it is. In fact, his trip up here has been hashtagged by his quasi-campaign as the Tell It Like It Is tour.
Oh.
So that's what he was doing.
Now, we heard the applause there. I mean, any way to know how entitlement reform such as that it would play in a state like New Hampshire?
It is so far seems to be playing okay. I mean, they like the fact, I've talked to, and some of the local interviews he's done while he's been up here has been on talk radio and talking to newspaper editorial boards. And they like the fact that he's talking about it. They like the fact that this is a fiscal issue and is all tied to making sure, you know, dealing with the national debt. But there's some controversial elements of the plan. He wants to raise the retirement age to 69 from 67, where the eligibility age for collecting Social Security. And the more controversial element is he doesn't want anybody who earns more than $200,000 a year in retirement income to collect Social Security. His line has been, my good friend Mark Zuckerberg doesn't need Social Security, talking about the Facebook founder who has been a political supporter of his in the past. And that has been deemed by some on the right as a wealth tax, the fact that rich people would pay into the system but not be able to collect. And his point is, you know, this is Social Security check for a rich person is meaningless. This is really an insurance policy for people who need it, not for everybody. But that's a controversial element, and that could potentially hurt him among some of the senior citizens who are, you know, a disproportional proportion of the primary electorate for the Republicans.
Of course, Mark Zuckerberg makes well more than $200,000 a year. Another
right.
thing is, you said Chris Christie is being fairly specific, and I think a lot more specific than the declared candidates, also wanting to eliminate the payroll taxes for people over the age of 62, and I would assume that might play well with a certain crowd.
Yeah, then that sort of he couples that with the $200,000 proposed rule on collecting Social Security. So, and he frames that as a way of keeping folks in the workforce if they want to continue to be in the workforce. That's his tax elimination element of his big plan. He also wants to take Medicaid for the needy and turn it into a program that would be run by states, which is something conservatives have liked in the past when other politicians have proposed such ideas.
Did he get into any arguments yesterday while he was in New Hampshire?
Amazingly, no arguments, but a lot of engagement. I mean, he is basically up here acting as a candidate. I mean, he went to a pizzeria, he walked down the main strip in Manchester, and then stopped. There was Ben and Jerry's was free cone day yesterday, so there was a huge queue of people, 100 people in line, and he shook hands. And he's been asked, and he was at a, I was just at it with him at a diner this morning. And he's been asked a lot of specific questions. He's been talking about Iran and student loans and Israel, and he has engaged people. He's disagreed with people, but the conversations have gone pretty smoothly, and people have enjoyed their interaction with him. And, you know, I think it's at least day one. This is a 3-day swing he's doing up here. Day one yesterday was pretty successful. I'm in the parking lot right now of a Lions club in a town called Lounsbury, and he is going to be doing a town hall meeting this morning. And that is key for him. I mean, these town hall meetings in New Jersey, as you know, are what kind of put him on the map nationally. He got all his YouTube moments from them. He both, you know, charmed and argued with people. He presented himself as a different kind of politician. So now he's taking the act on the road, see if it works in New Hampshire.
Is this a Christie you recognize? Matt, you've been covering for him for some time now.
Yeah, the Christie I saw in the last day or two seems a little more joyful than he has been over the last year or so. Like, he seems to be having a little bit of fun. He hasn't been having a lot of fun in New Jersey. The last year plus has been very rough for him. We have the Bridgegate scandal, which is still looming out there, still a federal investigation going. And whenever he's in New Jersey, that's what reporters want to talk to him about. That's why he hasn't done a press conference in New Jersey in almost 6 months. And he's also got tons of other problems in New Jersey, 8-credit downgrades. He's got problems with Sandy and the recovery not happening as quickly as people expected or hoped. Property taxes have the increases are continuing. They're slower than normal than they had been in the past, but people's property taxes are still going up. New Jersey's a bit of a downer for him, and he seems to be having a little bit more fun up here. It seems he's with Mary Pat, his wife. And they're enjoying all the, you know, the selfies and the kissing babies and the whole rigmarole.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Matt Katz. He's in a parking lot in New Hampshire, and he has been covering Chris Christie. He does this for New Jersey Public Radio for WNYC. And joining us in this first portion of Radio Times, as we talk about what Chris Christie is doing in New Hampshire, and apparently he's doing a lot. And you can send us an email, any questions or comments you might have, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, he also weighed into foreign policy. He talked about Iran. He talked about Putin. He talked about ISIS. He criticized the president. Is that something new for Christie?
No, he's criticized the president before on foreign policy, and he's presented a more hawkish approach to foreign policy than the president and probably folks like Senator Rand Paul, another Republican. But he got a little bit more specific this morning. Somebody asked him about the biggest threat to the country, and he said Iran, and then he went off criticizing the president's proposed deal with Iran on their nuclear facilities, and he said that is a national security threat. If this deal were to go through, that would be a national security problem for America. He is clearly carving out a hawkish, some might say neoconservative approach to foreign policy. He was asked what presidential candidate the mullahs in Iran, what presidential candidate Putin, Vladimir Putin of Russia, would least be happy about, who he doesn't want to be president.
And the answer?
The answer, he didn't specifically say him, but he did give a little tough talk. He said, I can't look into Putin's brain and see who he would want, who he wouldn't want as president. But I know that if he had to deal with me, it'd be he'd have a pretty tough go of things. So he presented himself as the one who can stand up to the bear in the East.
And I guess a way of also criticizing Hillary Clinton, of course, when she was Secretary of State.
Absolutely. It's a great play for a possible general election if you're running against somebody who's an actual diplomat and you want to be the one who, you know, is shaking the fist and fit.
Well, it's interesting because he says, if I run, I will beat her. Of course, she is now a declared candidate after a couple of years of will she, won't she. Is he kind of in his version of will he, won't he?
He is, although I don't think there's any question in my mind that he is in. I think what we're going to see over the next 2 months is he did this big policy address on Social Security yesterday. He's going to do three more big policy speeches, on including on defense, on tax policy, and on energy. And then after that, probably sometime in June, he's going to make the official announcement, and then he'll be off and running. I mean, remember, he's got two political action committees right now that are funding all of this pre-campaigning. He's got a PAC and a super PAC. So, I mean, he's essentially almost there. It's kind of a charade. I mean, there were 36 reporters yesterday following him around New Hampshire pizzeria. It wasn't because he's the governor of New Jersey. It's because everybody knows he's running for president.
He also said, and your reporting is great, I have to say, Matt, because it's full of very quotable quotes. He says, I'm a Northeast Republican who is a bit ethnic. What was he responding to when he said that?
Yeah, he was asked why if he's a conservative enough to win a Republican primary. And he said, I am conservative enough. He ticked off all the things in New Jersey that he's done, including rejecting money for Planned Parenthood, which, by the way, he used to frame as a fiscal decision, but is now evidence of his pro-life bona fides. So he ticked off all of his conservative credentials, and then he said the reason why people don't know I'm conservative is because they hear I'm from a northeastern state, and they hear that I'm a little, and they see that I'm a little ethnic. And I think that was a direct reference to Rudy Giuliani, another Italian-American from the Northeast, who had trouble and failed to get through the Republican primaries 8 years ago, 7 years ago, because he was deemed not conservative enough. So he's saying, I'm not Rudy Giuliani. And that was his subtle way of saying it. And I think I think there is something to that. I do think that there is a sense that Irish Americans, Italian Americans in the Northeast might be, you know, not as conservative as those in the early primary states like Iowa. So he was really addressing that head on. I mean, I don't think there's any other politician who would use words like that. And it was pretty interesting.
Well, Matt Katz, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You got it, Marty. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. And he is in a parking lot in New Hampshire, and he has been covering Chris Christie for New Jersey Public Radio and for WNYC. Coming up after this very short break, our guest is filmmaker Alex Garland. His debut film is called Ex Machina. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Alex Garland's debut film, Ex Machina, is about a young coder named Caleb who is tapped by his wealthy, reclusive boss, Nathan, to live for a week at his compound. He wants Caleb to determine whether his robot, Ava, is able to think and act like a human, to pass something called the Turing test. Here's a scene from the film where Nathan, played by Oscar Isaac, explains to Caleb, played by Donald Gleason, what he wants him to do.
Do you know what the Turing test is?
Yeah, I know what the Turing test is. It's when a human interacts with a computer. And if the human doesn't know they're interacting with a computer, the test is passed.
And what does the pass tell us?
That the computer has artificial intelligence. Are you building an AI?
I've already built one. And over the next few days, you're going to be the human component in the Turing test.
Holy.
That's right, Caleb. You got it. Because if that test is passed, you are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
If you've created a conscious machine, it's not the history of man. That's the history of gods.
Suffice it to say, things do not turn out as planned. Alex Garland's provocative thriller explores AI, artificial intelligence, consciousness, desire, sex, surveillance, technology, control. It's also beautifully filmed, and because I'm a radio person, I was completely captivated by the sound design. Alex Garland not only directed Ex Machina, he wrote it as well, and his other writing credits include 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, and Dread. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Alex Garland, great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your film.
Thanks very much. I have to say I'm very pleased you mentioned the sound design. People don't typically talk about sound design in film, and the sound design is a pretty important part of the team, and they did some particularly clever, interesting work on this film, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, as I said, I'm a radio person, so perhaps I'm sort of oriented that way.
I'm
tuned in, and I do want to get to the sound design, but let me get to the film itself. You have written for other directors, most notably for Danny Boyle. This you wrote for yourself.
Yeah.
Was that a different writing process for you?
Well, what I'm going to do in a slightly prickly way, but not directed at you, but aimed at the film industry, is take issue with the idea of writing for a director, because I never wrote for directors. I wrote screenplays not to put words on a page, but to put images on a screen, and then was one of the group of people that were involved in making the film. I think films are... I know we present films as owned by directors.
Sure.
and auteur theory gained enormous currency after the French sort of initially used it actually as a way of protecting the creative process, but I think it became a marketing tool, and it became a kind of bit of received wisdom that began to distract away from the truth, which is that film for the most part is collaborative. And I think that I think there are probably auteurs. I think I feel very comfortable with the idea of calling Woody Allen an auteur.
Right.
But it gets
but
used
not
in
you.
A... No, definitely not me. And it gets used in a blanket way. I'm very aware of what, well, sound designers, but also DOPs and production designers and writers do. So I wrote for a film, and the director was one of the people making that film, and I was another, and so were many other people. And that's also then true of this film, too.
Even though you're the director.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
I read that this movie really came from what sounds like a long-standing argument that you have or have had with a friend about computers and consciousness. I mean, and was it out of arguments? And which side of the argument were you on?
Well, there is a very reasonable, well-argued position, which is held by some fantastically intelligent people like Roger Penrose, sort of great minds of our time, really, that says machines are never going to be sentient. And that it's a complex argument, a very good argument. But essentially what it says is that there's something about human consciousness that we don't understand yet. And there are some indications of what that might be. And when we do understand it, we will discover that it precludes the possibility that a machine could be self-aware and sentient in the way that we are. And also in the way that animals are and stuff like that. And that was the position of my friend. And on an instinctive level, I didn't feel it was quite right. Hmm. I think because I'm sort of a physicalist. The mind is in the brain, and the brain is a physical object, and it's made of
atoms.
You can hold it in your hand. You can destroy it with a bullet or something like that. And it is about electrochemical actions with synapses and neurons. Therefore, it seems to me at least possible, plausible, that you might be able to do it. And that also is another school of thought, which is very well argued. And it's not like it's my idea. I'm just attaching myself to that. I think the thing really was that this friend of mine is basically more intelligent and better educated than I am. And so what I did was I started reading. And I read, and it's tough to read some of this stuff, but I did what I could. And at a certain point, the interest then morphs into being a narrative, basically because my job is I'm a writer.
Well, and what's so interesting is it set in this very wealthy man's compound. He has a internet company called Blue Book. It looks almost like Eden in a way. I mean, there's no one else around. There are mountains. It's beautiful landscape in this very kind of spare house that he lives in. And he asks this young coder who works for him to come in and do this Turing test. And I have to say, Oscar Isaac plays Nathan, the wealthy owner. I didn't recognize him. I recognized the voice, yeah. But I kept saying to myself, who is this actor? Why did you want him to play this part? And I have to say, he's pretty phenomenal in it.
Well, I wanted to pay him to do the part because he's just a ferociously talented actor. And that thing you said about not recognizing him, that's exactly correct.
And he's shaved head.
Yeah, but it's not just a physical thing. It's the way he inhabits a part. There are actors that do that. They disappear into the part and you cease to see either the actor that you knew before or previous performances. I mean, many actors are effectively doing a version of the same performance throughout their working life. And whereas if you look at Oscar Isaac, you could look at this film, Ex Machina, but you could look at Llewyn Davis or Most Violent Year, yeah. And not see him. Right. And that happened in quite a palpable way with him. 3 months or so before filming, there's this slim, handsome guy who plays the guitar, quite soft-spoken, sort of poetic guy, more like the Llewyn Davis character in some respects. And he says to me, yeah, I think this guy, I'm really going to pump him up. And I think, well, you've got 3 months. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know? And then when he turns up, he looks like a bull.
He so. Sure does. And I thought it was interesting because not only is the guy a genius in many ways, I mean, certainly intellectually above most people, he's so physically fit. I mean, you see him working out, that yeah. The sort of two sides of his self. And he also drinks a lot.
Yeah, the basic idea was that in some respects he was a kind of your worst nightmare of an alpha male. He's incredibly fit, he's intellectually very powerful, but he's also a bully.
Yes.
And predatory and threatening and implicitly violent. And so all of those are things that would intimidate another kind of man or woman in the way he presents himself. But he's also damaged because, I mean, as a sort of literary allusion, he's a bit like Kurtz, who spent too
Heart
much time,
darkness, right?
Yeah, too much time upriver with his behavior unmodified and has drifted down into a kind of self-destructive spiral.
Now, Caleb is this young coder, and again, played by Donald. Is that do that?
Donald
Gleason,
yeah.
Who also is really excellent in this. There's something very boyish, even kind of virginal about him. Was that part of what
yes,
you're thinking?
Because then it's a sort of alpha male meeting a beta male, or right. Or if that's the right Greek letter to throw in here,
I'm not sure which one
yeah,
it is.
But certainly not the alpha. It's not alpha versus alpha, and it's something else. And from him, you get a different kind of dynamic, which becomes someone who casts himself in a way as a hero to rescue this robot
yeah.
to some extent from the clutches of the what appears to be an antagonist. I think.
And the robot is Ava. No one has a last name, and I'm assuming that's by design.
Well, do you know, actually, I've been working as a writer for about 20 years, a little bit more, actually. And the first book I wrote was called The Beach.
Yes.
And I didn't put second names in it because they were sort of freighted with too much information, and I sort of wanted more blankness. It was almost the opposite of what you'd normally do in writing, which is to try and imply backstory or provide it. And I quite like blank characters where you see a window on them and there isn't too much external information. And I've carried that habit through. Mm. There's something about second names that are very telling. I think it comes from Dickens, maybe, where you know. I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, so I try and avoid it.
So we can sort of project our stuff onto these characters, you think?
Yes, because I think there's two ways you can sort of philosophically approach writing. One is you say as much as you possibly can and provide as much detail as you can. And certainly as a reader, I always felt that was wasted. I felt it was trying to fill in bits of detail that I didn't need filled in and actually were a sort of obstacle to my imagination. I was having to sort of wade through a lot of stuff. And actually, you can say two people talk in a cafe on a busy street, and you already are there in
sure.
many respects.
Sure.
And you don't need to know about the car horns or the texture of the pavement. And it can be slightly self-indulgent with writers, but the key is to engage the imagination of the reader in principle and so that they can project onto the story.
A woman, an actress, and she's a dancer as well, named Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, Vikander.
Vikander sure. plays Ava. It's fascinating to watch in that she is this robot.
She is.
And we can see through her torso.
And her legs and arms.
And her legs and her arms. Yeah. And she moves so beautifully. And again, to sound design, there's the very subtle sounds that you hear when she's walking like a dancer, really, across a room.
Yeah. So what both Alicia and the sound designers did was the same thing, really, which was to take maybe what you might expect in the movement of a robot or the sound of a robot and then go against it to an extent. What Alicia did was she did not robot movement, but human movement, but do it too perfectly. Because she's a ballerina and she has that degree of control over her physicality. She did human movements that look right. It's hard to pinpoint why anything would be wrong about them, but they're not quite right. There is a sort of otherness about them. And it's very seductive. It makes you kind of lean forward to the character in a strange way because it's intriguing. And that was something she came up with, which I thought was very smart. And the sound designers banned from their vocabulary anything like gears, servos, hydraulics, all of the things you might expect to find there, and instead put gyroscopes into oil and fill and taped what that sounded like, and created something which is very bold in some respects, which was to give her a pulse, a steady metronomic pulse, that a little sort of noise that is not in any way like a heartbeat, but is somehow makes you feel that there's a heartbeat and gives her life. It's very interesting. You take that out, and she dies a little bit. And you put it in and she's animated a little bit. And it's a purely audio thing.
Well, then that's how sound works in such a subliminal way.
We know it. Horror movies, right. If you're feeling scared, hit the mute button and you're not scared anymore. It suddenly feels banal and ridiculous. And put the music back on and you're terrified.
I do want to play another scene from the film. Just a quick reintroduction. That's Alex Garland, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His debut film is called Ex Machina. And it opens later in April. And we are talking about some of the ideas in the film and also what it took to make the film and also some of the actors as well. This is a scene where Caleb meets Ava for the very first time. Let's give it a listen.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Caleb.
Hello, Caleb.
Do you have a name?
Yes. Ava.
I'm pleased to meet you, Ava.
I'm pleased to meet you, too.
And again, another scene from the new film called Ex Machina. What I like about her movements, and you were talking about sort of how she sort of instinctively knew how to move as a dancer, is the way she would tilt her head. I mean, there was something a little bit animal about it, but just the sort of slight cock of her head, I thought, revealed so much as she was trying to sort of, I guess, figure out who this other person is that she's talking to.
Yeah.
And also her environment, and who knows what's going on in her brain, too.
Well. Yes, exactly. And reductively, that's what the whole film is about. It's basically about the degree to which we either can or can't establish what is going on in someone else's brain or something else's brain, sort of what we establish and what we fail to establish.
I have to say that, and I don't want to give too much away, but there is something about her. There's another very, I guess she's the maid. She's another character who has nothing to say, but nonetheless. And then we also see a closet in Nathan's bedroom of what look like sex dolls to me. I mean, dolls sort of hanging in the closet.
Well, are presented exactly as that, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And one wonders also about, and I'm just curious whether you were looking at how men might fabricate and make a kind of fantasy doll for themselves. And there is sex talk in this. Nathan says to Caleb, she would like to have sex. She can feel what it's like to have sex.
Yeah, I mean... Yes. I mean, the question that you've just stated has so many answers rush into my mind that it's difficult to kind of order any of them in a sense. Basically, this is an ideas movie and it's presenting a bunch of ideas, some of which have answers and some of which don't. I think some of which don't have any, like we literally don't know the answer to these questions, and some of them we do or can present one. And some of them are to do with consciousness, some of them are to do with AI, some of them are to do with big tech companies, and some of them are to do with gender. And the way in which genders relate to each other. You could say, for example, the objectification of women in their early 20s. And actually, I think when I say that, people always assume that that means the male depiction and fetishization of women in their early 20s or objectification. But actually, women also objectify women in their early 20s. So it's a complex thing. I think where the gender stuff starts for me in the film, in fact, they have a conversation about this in a sense midway through, is partly whether there is a relationship between consciousness and sexuality.
Right.
And also whether where gender resides. Is gender something which is seated in consciousness? So in other words, there would be such a thing as a male and female mind. And lots of people think there are, but I slightly struggle with that idea in many respects, because then it would imply that there are things that men think that women don't think, and vice versa. And I always think, at that point, well, I would then be able to find a man that doesn't think that and a woman that does.
Right.
And so
right.
So how do you demonstrate it in some respects? So then also it can be, and the film is aiming, trying to aim squarely at this stuff. Is gender then something that is conferred on you by other people? So if you live for 20 years as a woman, you know what it is to be a woman because you've been treated as a woman, and that is the experience of being a woman, therefore you have a female gender. Or is it neither of those things, and it's housed just in an outward physical appearance? So a male mind and a female mind are basically the same, but one has a male body and the other has a female body. So there's a whole bunch of things that attach themselves to that starting point, but that is the starting point.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then
Sorry,
we'll get back.
No,
you did perfectly fine. Alex Garland is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His new film, it's his debut film, is called Ex Machina. That's what we've been talking about. He also wrote it as well. His other writing credits include 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, and Dread. He's also the author of a couple of novels, including The Beach and The Tesseract. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. If you want to join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The new science fiction thriller Ex Machina explores the possibility of thinking and feeling robots. It's about a coder who was tapped by his wealthy boss to test the consciousness of a robot he has created at his home and research center set in the wilderness. And the movie opens on April 24th. This is Alex Garland's first film as a director. And again, as I mentioned, he wrote the screenplay to the zombie flick 28 Days Later, along with the films The Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, and Dread. And to join the conversation, again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. As you were talking about, you know, what does it sort of mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? This film also seemed to me is about passing. It's about passing. I mean, it's clear that Ava, the robot, is a woman. I mean, she has a woman's body. But the idea of not just passing as a woman, but I have to say over time, as a viewer, she becomes a woman. I mean, she becomes less robot and more human, at least to my eyes.
Yeah.
And my experience.
Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of my position as well. I'm not exactly sure she turns into a woman. Maybe she does. I don't know. But what she becomes is something that's equal to us, at least, right, and has the same requirements in terms of the way we should respect her, essentially, and that she has rights.
I mean, I don't know if identify is exactly the right word.
No, identify is fine. I certainly empathize with Ava, I would say. Although that sounds like it might be a sort of good bit of filmmaking or a sort of clever trick, but actually humans do that pretty, it's almost hard to stop them doing it.
Mm.
We're sort of helpless in our magical thinking and helpless in the degree to which we project sentience into things. Children believe their teddy bears are alive. It's hard to persuade them that they're not. And actually, adults in truth hold on to that. They believe that their fountain pen that's stopped working or their laptop, which is playing up, is being sort of mischievous or aggressive or messing with them in some kind of way. And that's projecting a consciousness into an object that really doesn't have it.
Kind of superstitious behavior, right?
Well, I think there's actually a very, very strong argument that says we are all superstitious. However rational we think we are, we actually are superstitious in our thought patterns. Yeah,
I read a quote, something you said at the South by Southwest, that robots might be more reasonable than we are. Does that sound like you?
That certainly sounds like me, yeah. I mean, to me, that's completely plausible. Just to give a for instance, if it's reasonable to do
sure.
So. In the UK, we have the National Health Service. It's a big tax-funded health system that everyone has available to them. And running that system is incredibly difficult. And it's run by humans, largely. And the allocation of medicines and the way in which there's an ebb and flow of the requirement of these things, different hospitals requiring different amount of finance, or there's a flu epidemic, or whatever it happens to be, is fantastically difficult to stay on top of and subject to political pressures. There's an election campaign going on in the UK at the moment. You're just about to have one here,
right?
Too. And health is always top of the agenda in many respects. And so funding of the health service becomes a sort of political issue. Now, a really good AI, I'm not saying it would run it better, but it's plausible to me that it might be able to run it better. So I guess that's what I mean.
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember 5 or 6 years ago hearing about self-driving cars, and I thought, oh, my gosh, how ridiculous.
Mm.
But we see that we are closer and closer to self-driving cars because they, you know, when they back up, there are sounds and things that are...
We could have them now. I mean, actually, the technology exists right now while we're talking to have them, and they do actually exist. The only thing that stops them being on the streets are legal issues about liability if there's a crash.
But they probably would be, at least today's drivers in this country, they probably would do a better job on the road.
But they could easily do a better job.
Right.
And when we get in aeroplanes and we do big flights, a lot of that is controlled by AIs, and they do it better than the pilots.
Mm.
You know, recently a pilot flew his plane into the Alps. An AI wouldn't do that, at least for emotional reasons.
I do want to play another scene from Ex Machina. And this is Caleb and Nathan are talking. Caleb, the coder. Nathan is the CEO of the company. And this is sort of as this experiment or this test begins to take a darker turn. And this is Nathan talking. Let's give it a listen.
You feel bad for Ava? Feel bad for yourself, man. One day the AIs are going to look back on us the same way we look at fossil skeletons in the plains of Africa. An upright ape living in dust with crude language and tools, all set for extinction.
I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
There you go again, Mr. Quotable.
There you go again. It's not my quote. It's what Oppenheimer said after he made the
atomic
bomb.
Yeah, I know what it is, dude.
I know what it is, dude. So is this sort of a story of evolution?
Yeah, kind of. I think so. To an extent, in its the way it is, there's a lot of anxiety about artificial intelligence, and it's not unreasonable. We could have AIs controlling drones really quite soon that would be making kill decisions over human beings, and that's a good reason to feel anxious. That there's a lot of ethical problems and stuff like that. But the basic issue, it seems to me, is that we tend to imagine AIs as something that exist in a parallel way to us. And I think because it's a parallel existence, we start to feel rivalrous about it, as if you're on a racetrack and these things may start to go faster than you and leave you behind. And so that worries us. And in those terms, it's sort of understandable to feel worried. But if you configure the AI in a different way, you could say in an evolutionary way, but I think I tend to see it as more like children, as a product of us. a continuation of us and something where we're on the same track. They wouldn't exist without us, and they might be modelled on our versions of consciousness and stuff like that. Then suddenly it becomes less threatening. We accept the idea that our children will live longer than us. In fact, it's the very least we expect. It's the very least we'd hope for.
Live longer and better, hopefully.
Live longer and better, indeed, yeah. And the point is that if the AI is sentient, it has an emotional life, then... why wouldn't we value it and cherish it? That's what we value and cherish about each other. It is our internal existence. If we were all trees, we wouldn't be valued by the other trees and we wouldn't value ourselves. Trees are great, but they're not sentient.
No, but we need trees as well.
No, they're lovely. I'm not knocking trees.
No, I understand. I understand. That would be a first for us if you were knocking trees.
Yeah.
Where did you film this? Because
place with a lot of trees.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of trees there and mountains with snow caps and a beautiful feel sort of blown by the wind.
All the exteriors and the locations were shot in Norway. Which is a very dramatic, really exceptionally beautiful landscape. And one of the things about it is that it's not that familiar to us. The Alps are very familiar. Yosemite is very familiar. Mm-hmm. Alaska, in some respects, has become familiar. Iceland has become familiar because even if we don't know we see it, it's in, what's the Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Ben Stiller adaptation of that James Thurber story, and Interstellar and things like this. They're shot in Iceland. And in odd ways, the fabric of the landscape just sort of enters into our minds. But Norway has something sort of untapped and very dramatic and beautiful and wild too.
And the house that's there, is that an actual, someone's actual house?
Yeah, it is. Norway's a very interesting country because it's the only country in the world that nationalized its oil industry and then did the right thing with it, which was to keep all the money. And so it's unbelievably affluent. Mm-hmm. And it's also spread the money around. It's not held by one royal family. It's used for the good of the general country. And this affluence shows itself in all sorts of different ways. And one way is you find these amazing architectural constructions in the middle of nowhere. And so there was a house and a hotel in this extraordinary landscape, and we shot there.
Oh, a tweet from John saying, really looking forward to this masterpiece, as he calls it. It may help me understand my relationship with Siri on my iPhone. I mean, this is a slightly different relationship, but we do have a relationship with our technology. I mean, we're always reaching for them.
But this, I mean, in a way, this is the thing, isn't it? Is that Siri isn't in any respect sentient. I mean, literally in no way at all. And yet, there are moments when you can feel a flash of sentience because that's what we're coded to do. And we attribute more intelligence to things than actually exist. Mm. I think we certainly do that with animals. Nature documentaries routinely attribute behavior, sort of thought patterns to animals that probably aren't there. But we also do it to ourselves. And when I say they're not there, I don't mean that in a sort of derogatory way. I just mean they have a different kind of consciousness to us. And it's very hard, it's wrong to put our kind of thinking onto their kind of thinking. They have their own way of thinking. But we tend to put our way of thinking onto everything.
Let me ask you something that I observed, and I didn't know if it was on purpose or not. There's a scene where Caleb, the young coder, takes off his shirt, and you see a scar on his back.
Yes.
Is that his own scar? Is it
the actor's scar?
Is it? Yeah.
No, that's a movie scar.
That's a movie
scar. That's the magic of the movies.
Oh, right? So I was trying to think,
what that's
why
about.
Does he have a scar?
Well, I'm going to tell you. but it's what they call a spoiler.
Okay.
Essentially what it is that I'm aware that film audiences tend to be very kind of cine literate. They tend to have seen a lot of movies and they've seen Blade Runner. And they know that there is a chance that the real robot that the test is happening on is, say, this young man. And things like that within the film are nudging you towards asking that question and posing it.
You grew up, Claire, you're British. You grew up in a family. Your dad was a political cartoonist?
Yeah.
And your mom, a psychoanalyst?
She became one, yeah.
She became a psychoanalyst. Up, yeah. So where did you live? Where did you grow up?
In London.
In London itself?
Yeah. And yes, in a sort of a family really with a lot of journalists around. My dad was a political cartoonist, but newspapers typically have one political cartoonist, or maybe two, but in those days, at any rate, one. And so his pals were journos, and for some reason, I never really understood, most of them were foreign correspondents.
Oh, interesting.
And so
at the house kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. One of them in particular, who back then, this was in the 70s, in the early 70s, was covering Vietnam and Cambodia, and he'd come back with little sort of Cambodian sweets and little canvas bags that were kind of military bags that used to get sold. And that certainly made a big impression on me as a child. In a way, it actually led to my job because... Yeah. Because these correspondents that were constantly passing through the house led me in actually quite a direct way, because I went to go and live with one of them in the Philippines, led to me going to Asia a lot. And then I ended up writing about Asia, and
the
that
beach.
became a job, became a working life for me.
But did you think you might be a journalist or maybe even
I
a political cartoonist?
I sometimes thought I might be a cartoonist, but. But if you grow up with one, you realize you're not going to be able to hack it if you're not good enough. I certainly had that realization. I thought I'd be a foreign correspondent, like these guys that were drifting through the house, and set out to try and do that. But I wasn't suited for it. I find myself. It's just more comfortable writing nonfiction, writing fiction than nonfiction, and I gave it a shot, but it didn't work out.
Do you like the solitariness of writing fiction? I'm assuming it's solitary.
It's very solitary, and I don't like that. No,
you don't like
no,
that?
No, I don't like it at all. And in fact, the reason I stopped writing novels and started working in film was to avoid that.
Oh, because films are so collaborative.
Are collaborative.
Right.
Which is part means I arrived in it thinking I'm looking for a group of people to work with, which is why I slightly reject the sort of director godhead thing, because it was the collaboration that drew me to it.
That said, what kind of director are you, or did you
a were collaborative
you,
one?
I know, I understand that, but I mean, on the set, what are you doing, or what do you like to do?
Well, I mean, you're directing the movie as best you can, and
right.
Sort of keeping it sort of on a particular kind of wavelength, I guess, and talking to everybody. But I think the key, often the key is that certainly where I've observed directing going wrong in the past on other productions is that directors feel they've got a way of doing something, and then somebody suggests another way of doing it, and fear sort of freezes them up, because it can be quite hard to open up your mind to a new idea in a pressured environment, and a set is definitely a pressured environment.
Sure.
And so what I try to do is keep my mind open to other people's suggestions and not get too locked into ideas, and actually delegate as much as possible and try and keep it friendly, actually, because sets, because they're pressured, can also become very, very unpleasant environments with a lot of shouting and a lot of kind of brutal behavior. And
not on your set?
No. The only bit of fascism I do is that if people do that, they get sacked.
Ah, interesting.
That's the one.
Have you
bit
had
of
to
fascism.
Do that?
I have, yes.
Yes. Are you pleased with Ex Machina?
It's the only thing I've ever done that I feel pleased with. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, I feel real.
Because you've done a lot.
Yeah, and some of it's been lousy and really flawed. And this one was a fantastic group of people and a great vibe. And we had some aims, and I think we achieved them. And other things I did, I felt very vulnerable to criticism. And this, if people don't like it, I just think, whatever. Right.
And have you watched it with people?
I have in test screenings, but not since the film was finished and handed over. I mean, I've seen fragments of it, but I've never actually re-watched a film or reread a book.
Will you re-watch this film?
It's the only one I might.
You might. When you're ready?
I think I probably won't, but it's the only one I might.
Right, because you feel that much better about it than your other work?
Way better. There's no comparison.
Well, Alex Garland, it's been such a pleasure. Congratulations on Ex Machina. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Radio Time.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And again, the film is called Ex Machina, and it opens nationwide on April 24th. His writing credits include 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, and Dread. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back for hour two.